What up, y'all? This your main man, Memphis Bleek, right here, host the Rock Solid Podcast. June is Black Music Month, so what better way to celebrate than listening to my exclusive conversation with my bro, Ja Rule?
The one thing that can't stop you or take away from you is knowledge. So whatever I went through while I was down in prison for 2 years, through that process, learn from it.
Check out this exclusive episode with Ja Rule on Rock Solid. Open your free iHeartRadio app, search Rock Solid, and listen now.
I think everything that might have dropped in 95 has been labeled the golden years of hip-hop.
It's Black Music Month, and We Need to Talk is tapping in. I'm Nyla Simone, breaking down lyrics, amplifying voices, and digging into the culture that shaped the soundtrack of our lives.
Like, that's what's really important, and that's what stands out, is that our music changes people's lives for the better.
Let's talk about the music that moves us. To hear this and more on how music and culture collide, listen to We Need to Talk from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I also want to address the Tonys.
On a recent episode of Checking In with Michelle Williams, I open up about feeling snubbed by the Tony Awards. Do I?
I was never mad. I was disappointed because I had high hopes.
To hear this and more on disappointment and protecting your peace, listen to Checking In with Michelle Williams from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On September 15th, 1988, there was an argument inside a Philadelphia row house. As one party tried to leave, the other man followed, making threats that left him fatally shot. The victim's brother only knew one man in that party, Trevor Mattis. But Trevor maintained that he was just a bystander. Then another eyewitness corroborated that story. Yet this eyewitness said something else at Trevor's trial. This is wrongful conviction.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I'm Ben Bolin from The Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, and once again, I'm excited to be hosting the show. In this episode, we're speaking with our guest, Trevor Mattis, who is calling in from a Pennsylvania correctional facility to share his story. Trevor, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And folks, if we're detecting an accent here, that's because Trevor originally traveled to the U.S. as a student from Jamaica.
Right. I just came from a background of working class, single-parent household, and she had her brothers, so I had an extended family. You just run into anybody's house. That's just how it is in the community that I came from. Property is almost like a communal property with many special for children. Growing up as an only child, a lot of times I was with my grandmother. She was a retired teacher, so I think she instilled in me from a very early age the love of knowledge, reading specifically, but I was drawn to the sciences as I grew up, specifically biology. Then I was always achieving in school without any extra prompting.
And Trevor's academic achievement continued. His high scores on placement tests put him in the best high school in all of Jamaica. And soon it came time to take the Jamaican equivalent to the SATs.
I know my mom, as a single parent, she always told me to shoot for it without really being a conviction that I was going to achieve it. And then one day, sure enough, came back. You have been accepted to City University of New York, York College. So when I got accepted, that was another shock because that causes a financial commitment that she wasn't really prepared for. Tuition is like twice the amount of the regular tuition when you're coming from a foreign country or whatever. So she always told me, there's one mantra she always had. She said, I'm not rich, I can't leave you riches, but I'm going to make sure you get a good education. At that point in time, because the promise was made, she found a way to not disappoint. With that now, the scramble was on, well, who are you going to stay with? housing arrangement, blah, 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 and just extended friends and family and network. Somewhere was found to me that was in Queens Village. So I end up in Queens, going to York College.
So at this point, Trevor is a pre-med biology major, and he ended up graduating with honors. He is planning to become a dentist, and he can pretty much go to any school he wishes for this.
After I finished, was interested in one of those schools in Philly, like Temple or University of Bend, and a friend from the neighborhood, he was actually resided in Philadelphia. So he used to come back and forth. So he said, well, whenever I'm ready, I should come up with him, and then I could stay with him in his apartment. And then he was part of this community of Jamaican guys, young guys. And I think it was during the spring and the summer. It's like somewhere around there when the weather was nice. So we used to play scrimmage, soccer, dominoes. And as a naive young person, initially, to me, it was almost like a boys' camp. Because there are all these young guys, young Jamaicans, basically a cohesive little unit. And it was just about fun, flirting with girls or whatever, just being a young man.
For some quick context here, it was the summer of 1988, and while Trevor was enjoying this coming-of-age experience, the crack epidemic had swept across many American cities, and this also applied to Philadelphia. It appears that some of the young men we've mentioned were involved.
I got to realize that they were involved in the drug game, but was not right where we were staying at. There was just like an old hangout spot because it was well kept. It was owned by a Jamaican elder to us. And so we used to go there and hang out upstairs, but drugs would be sold from the basement.
And it was soon discovered that this house on Louise Street in Philadelphia was already under federal surveillance. The focus was on a man named Franklin Watson. He was present on the night of the incident, September 14th into the 15th, 1988, when the crew selling drugs out the basement included a man named Kirk Crump, as well as two brothers, Paul White and Everton Meade Johnson. Trevor showed up with a man named Mikey Donovan, who was visiting from out of town.
He was basically new to Philadelphia, not somebody I really had no extensive long-term relationship with. We met each other through somebody, and he said he wanted to see what Philly was like. And we had a good rapport at that time.
So Trevor took Mikey Donovan to this hangout spot that doubled as a drug house to see the owner of the place, Rudy, but they spoke to Kirk Crump instead.
When I arrived, it was early in the morning, like 12:31 a.m., and I was surprised to see a lot of the other guys upstairs in the living room. But these are guys that I know. The guy I'm with, Mikey Donovan, doesn't know them. So when I spoke to her in the kitchen, they said something like, oh, so many people in the house, or why so many people know, something like that. But it was just basically generalized conversation, not about whether someone should be here or not. So Johnson in the basement must have heard. He must have phone was offended, and I don't know. And he stomped up the steps. It was like boom, boom, boom. Flung the door open, and it hit, bam. And then his first words was, why the fuck you want to know? So why so much people know? Something like that. A very bellicose manner. He liked to intimidate people because he was kind of big. But that's just his personality, how he acts. Mike Donovan, who was right beside me, don't know this person. So he just basically, he asked me in a low tone. He asked me, who is this guy? Why is he talking so rough? That further incited Johnson. So he basically was like, pussy, who are you? Out the blue, pussy, who are you? You know me? And the code of the streets at that time. A remark like that basically is a declaration of war. So that immediately escalated things. I couldn't understand where's all of that coming from. I was like, what can be done to de-escalate? That was my first thought. He was like stepping towards an aggressive type step. So I basically put myself in between both of them, and I was pleading with him. I said, listen, calm down. What's this all about? That's uncalled for. So I basically got him to step back and take a seat on the stool. And he was in a steering contest now with Mikey Donovan behind me. So it's a hardcore glare locked in this real tunnel vision with anger. You know what I mean? Glaring at him. And I have no clue what the reaction is going to be from Mikey Donovan, who is behind me. And so I looked towards Kurt, the guy that was in the kitchen I was speaking to, and I said, where is Rudy? Just out of the blue, basically just trying to change something. And he said he just left. He went to the bus stop to escort his daughter to work. So that basically gave me an opportunity now to say, well, all right, let me go find him. So I'm just trying to divert. I said, come, let's go, or something to that effect. I'm trying to beckon Donovan to come, and took two more steps towards the front door, as if, you know me, this is nothing big, something like that. And when I look back one more time, I see him, like a step back, relaxed. Therefore, I figured that the gambit worked, because that looked like nothing further going to go. So I hastened my step towards the front door, opened the front door. I was ahead by a couple of steps. I looked back, and I seen Mikey Dunn was just emerging out the front door. So while I'm thinking that I'm taking these steps towards the bus stop now, I hear the screen door clang again. That means somebody had come out by the time it shut. When I turned around on the streets, Johnson was by his car trunk, and his car trunk was already open, and he was reaching in. Mikey Donovan was on the sidewalk. Johnson said something. Most likely it would have been something intimidating. And the moment he said something, Mikey Donovan pulled a gun out his waist and opened fire immediately.
This Pride Month, we are not just celebrating, we're fighting back. I'm George M. Johnson, and my book, All Boys Aren't Blue, was just named the most banned book in America. If the culture wars have taught me anything, it's that pride is protest. And on my podcast, Fighting Words, we talk to people who use their voices to resist, disrupt, and make our community stronger.
This year, we are showing up and showing out.
You need people being like, no, you're not going to tell us what to do.
This regime is coming down on us, and I don't want to just survive. I want to thrive.
You'll hear from trailblazers like Bob the Drag Queen.
To freedom!
Angelica Ross.
We ready to fight? I'm ready to fight.
And Gabrielle Union.
Hi, George.
And storytellers with wisdom to spare. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everton Meade Johnson was shot fatally. According to the autopsy report, the bullet entered from the back of his body toward the front. Perhaps Mikey Donovan didn't wait for Meade Johnson to turn around and fire. And since the scene of the crime was in front of a drug house, it appears no one stuck around to speak to the police, except for the victim's brother, Paul White. According to others, Paul had tried to stop his brother from following Donovan. And then he ran to the basement to get help during the shooting, but he told police something else.
Because he had never seen Mikey Donovan in his life, he immediately told them he saw two people shooting his brother. He identified me along with this unknown Jamaican male I didn't know. He said, I had a Tech-9, a big machine gun, and Mikey Donovan had a handgun. And he said both of us basically ambushed him at the corner of the car, and I was shooting, and Donovan was shooting. There were 7 shots fired. So that was basically what he told them at the scene of the crime. What the state did know, because it happened at a drug house, the state really created this narrative of a drug turf warfare. So they took that and said, well, it was a dispute of who was supposed to sell drugs out the house. Now, me and Johnson are friends from back then, you know what I mean? We're not enemies. That's not how we operate. If he wanted to sell drugs out of the house, he had all the right. Kirk is the one selling the house, so anybody could make some type of arrangement with Kirk or whatever. So it wasn't no circumstance that we would be in competition or anything like that. It's just an absurd story. But the state basically said, I took it upon myself to eliminate my rivals.
So Trevor was arrested, and over time, this unknown Jamaican is eliminated from the narrative.
So nobody could identify him. Nobody knew where he was. So basically, after I was made the target, the state and everyone just didn't try to find out anything further about Mikey Donovan. That's just how it works. they had the target that they wanted, and everything was just geared to get this target, regardless what is my turn up.
Speaking of, while Trevor sat in pretrial detention for nearly 2 years, the separate federal investigation of the drug house closed in on Franklin Watson, who was present on the night of the murder and tried to trade information for leniency. And this was 3 weeks before trial in January 1990. The feds told the prosecution about this witness, but for reasons that we'll discuss later, the defense remained in the dark about this and a number of other things, including, for instance, why the state wanted a bench trial.
When I got to the courtroom, I requested a jury trial, and then my lawyer got very outraged and told me that he had an agreement with the prosecutor to not seek the death penalty if I took a non-jury trial. But I still was trying to be adamant. So a couple of minutes before the trial started, my mom was there, and she came to me in tears and distraught, telling me that I should listen to the lawyer because he told her that they don't like Jamaicans in Philadelphia at that time, and I'm going to fry in the electric chair. She was so broken that, and that broke me just to see her so distraught. So I relented and basically went along.
So perhaps the state was confident that the assigned judge would give them their desired result, as would Franklin Watson.
The morning of the trial, the prosecutor announced that a surprise witness just walked into his office 5 minutes before the trial started and said he was there. And this is how he announced Watson. So when he puts him on the stand, Watson testifies that he was present. Watson's the first person ever said that there was an argument in the house, in the kitchen, between Johnson and I over who should sell drugs from that location. And then he said for the first time also that I brandished a weapon in the house and had to be restrained by others. Then I walked out. Johnson followed me out. We began to fight outside for 1 minute by the car trunk, and then I got the better of Johnson, pulled a weapon, and shot him multiple times from close range. And no one else was involved, blah, blah, blah.
So in contrast to Paul White's original statement about two shooters, Watson named Trevor as the lone shooter. And on cross-examination, Trevor's attorney was able to expose Watson's vulnerability.
He got the fact that Watson was a federal informant out on the stand. But the lawyer, he never followed up to find out what was happening. What did he say to the feds? It was just letter that just came out. So basically, that was how he impeached the credibility. And as soon as he finished testifying, the prosecutor rested their case. They were like, well, we're not going to call the original White no more. We resting. My lawyer objected. He requested a mistrial, saying, Your Honor, this is a trial by ambush. We have been waiting for this case for over 2 years. We have all this discovery. Nowhere in the entire discovery was a Watson mentioned. They brought this person at the 12th hour, claiming that he's a surprise witness, and now they want to arrest the case. They had the sidebar, and then prosecutor relented and said, Your Honor, postpone the case for 1 day, and then we will bring White the following day.
Additionally, and this is absent from the record, Watson escaped a potential 30-year sentence in exchange for this testimony. And then came Paul White.
So the next day he brought White to the stand, and White's entire testimony was radically different. And it mimicked almost play-by-play what Watson said. So initially White was talking about two people shooting. Now he changed. And he said there was only one person, and that was me. And he also added an altercation, because there was never an altercation mentioned anywhere at the scene of the crime or at the preliminary hearing a year after. But at the trial, he testified there was an altercation, but he said it didn't last a minute. He said it lasted a few seconds before I brandished a weapon and shot Johnson. So that's how his testimony changed to mimic what Watson said. But he did not repeat the allegation of it was an argument over drugs.
Unfortunately, the inconsistencies between White's statements, as well as how they were inconsistent with Watson's, these issues are never pointed out to the judge.
When Paul White said, I hit the victim in the head with a gun, you know, you hit somebody in the head with a gun, the autopsy going to show that's a specific mark that a gun would leave. And then White actually said the federal informant was not there to witness it. And the federal informant said White was not there. He said White was in the basement. And a federal informant said, I had a chrome 9mm. White said, first it was a Tech-9 machine handgun. And then at the trial testimony, he said it was a 9mm, but it was brown.
So without these glaring inconsistencies pointed out, or what else was hidden from the court at the time, the judge made his decision on the first-degree murder, criminal conspiracy, and weapons charges.
He basically summarized the case and said it was a straightforward, clear-cut case of a jug turf dispute, and I, the defendant, took it upon myself to eliminate my rival once and for all by gunning him down in cold blood. And within less than 60 seconds, I was found guilty. With the automatic sentence of life without the possibility of parole. And my mom was there, so you know that basically broke her heart.
This Pride Month, we are not just celebrating, we're fighting back. I'm George M. Johnson, and my book, All Boys Aren't Blue, was just named the most banned book in America. If the culture wars have taught me anything, it's that pride is protest. And on my podcast, Fighting Words, we talk to people who use their voices to resist, disrupt, and make our community stronger.
This year, we are showing up and showing out.
You need people being like, no, you're not going to tell us what to do.
This regime is coming down on us. And I don't want to just survive. I want to thrive.
You'll hear from trailblazers like Bob the Drag Queen.
To freedom!
Angelica Ross.
We ready to fight? I'm ready to fight.
And Gabrielle Union.
Hi, George.
And storytellers with wisdom to spare. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When I'm looking back on the whole scenario, it was basically a process with a foregone conclusion, maybe 2 months after I was convicted. I received a statement that was made 3 weeks before my trial by Watson to the federal authorities, which was a part of his plea deal to the federal authorities. And in the statement, it was exculpatory, specifically stated that he was present at the Johnson shooting, that Johnson was shot by Mikey Donovan, and I was merely a bystander. And that was just 3 weeks before my trial. He spoke to the feds and told them basically a true version of events, and then came into the state trial and gave a whole separate contradictory statement for state prosecutor.
This was clearly a Brady violation. It upended the state's case. So this won Trevor an evidentiary hearing on direct appeal.
The same judge that convicted me held an evidentiary hearing. 5-6 months after I was convicted, the federal prosecutors were put on the stand. And they corroborated the authenticity of the Watson plea deal statement that I had. So when they saw that I was about to go to trial for the case, they contacted this prosecutor and conveyed the information that he might have the wrong perpetrator. And that is how the state prosecutor became aware of Franklin Watson and made arrangements to interview Watson. One of the federal prosecutors said he specifically recalled that name, Sax, because it was the saxophone or something to that effect.
So it appears that Trevor's prosecutor, Richard Sachs, received this information that Trevor was indeed an innocent bystander. But somehow, on the eve of the trial, Watson changed his story. This allowed Sachs to forge ahead with the prosecution anyway, in spite of the federal prosecutor's efforts.
They gave it to him orally over the phone. The prosecutor took the stand also. He said he didn't receive specific information that he might have the wrong perpetrator. So they contradicted each other, but the judge said he found both parties to be truthful.
Even though these testimonies are in direct contradiction.
And then the judge did mental gymnastics by saying, since the federal authorities conveyed the information orally over the telephone and not in writing, the information would not amount to really, because a state prosecutor had nothing physically to turn over to the defense.
Wow.
Yeah, but then he went even further. I guess he knows that wouldn't pass the smell test, so he came up with this rationale. He said, well, even if the document was available and turned over to the defense and the federal informant testified exactly to the exculpatory statement he made in that document, he would have still have found me guilty, not as a perpetrator this time, but as a co-conspirator. And the laws at that time will be sentenced exactly the same way, mandatory life without parole.
Even though the only witness, Watson, who even said anything about a criminal conspiracy, that Trevor had allegedly killed Meade Johnson to take out a rival dealer, that witness had just been clearly proven to have lied.
So I told my lawyer immediately, we have to appeal this. And he was like, of course. So he agreed to file an appeal. And they sent me off state now, and I was actually in the hole at that time. And weeks went by, I sent letters, never got no response, never. Weeks and weeks went by, then I reached out to my family and said, can you contact this lawyer and find out what's going on with my appeal? He informed them that he did not file an appeal within the time frame, the 30-day window to file the notice of appeal, so the issue became waived according to the legal language. Basically, I gave up on that issue.
And with that failure, he's barred from raising the issue again in state court. So he tries federal court.
There's a federal magistrate that got the case, and he ordered that I be retried within 120 days or be released. The state appealed his decision, and the district judge reversed the magistrate's opinion, upheld the conviction, maintaining that there was a procedural default. Therefore, the federal courts cannot entertain this issue whatsoever because the state did not get full opportunity to reverse their own mistake or their own issue. And I appealed that to the appellate court at the federal level. They ruled that they were very troubled by the circumstances of this case. And they clearly articulated that they will not decide this case on the merits, whether or not this judge is ruling that oral communication is not Brady. However, they could not overcome the procedural default issue for that claim to be entertained in the federal courts. So, as a result, they upheld the conviction with the asterisk that they were very troubled by the circumstances.
So the case-breaking evidence that surfaced back in 1990 has effectively been neutered by the system since 1991. The fight was fortunately revived in 2011. This is when the man who was in the kitchen that night, Kurt Crump, sent Trevor an affidavit.
The affidavit basically clarified that he operated that residence and that the victim, Johnson, was one of his friends, that a confrontation occurred in the kitchen between Johnson and Donovan. And I intervened, calmed Johnson down. I left the house with Donovan in tow, and he said that Johnson was angry, said he was going to get his gun, and White tried to stop him from barging out. Johnson shoved White aside and stormed out behind Donovan, and said that White ran down the basement to gather two other guys. So Kirk trailed behind Johnson to the front door, and in his affidavit he described he saw Johnson reach in the trunk when Mike Donovan shot him multiple times.
And that version of events is corroborated by the trajectory of the bullets from the back to the front. This contradicted both trial witness testimonies, and it continued to further discredit Paul White.
When the shots were fired, Kirk heard White and the guy from the basement coming up behind him from the kitchen. Basically, that White was not a witness because he said White was behind him when the shots got fired. But they heard the shots, and when he turned, they already had began to flee back down the basement. He can exit the residence through the basement. And that basically was it. And he actually did a follow-up with a sworn video deposition to corroborate the affidavit. And I submitted all of that to the state court. And it was denied. It said, untimely, no explanation. I appealed that to the state appellate courts. And they ruled that this evidence was untimely, but they gave their explanation. They said it was cumulative because it produced no new facts. It basically said the same thing that the defense said. They said, I should have gotten him. And basically, they didn't say I could have gotten him. They didn't tell me how I was going to get him. They did not discuss the fact that the state was looking for Kirk Crumb because he was one of the persons that was in the discovery as a witness.
So you heard that right, folks. Not even the state can find this guy, yet Trevor is expected to do so. It turned out that Kirk Crump had been arrested in another state under an alias before he was deported to Jamaica. So finding him would have been nearly impossible. Yet when Trevor appealed to the federal courts, they said that these two factors made the witness unreliable. And so they denied him as well.
Subsequent, now in 2023, friends and family finally get the resources to hire a forensic expert, Dr. Shirley from Pittsburgh. And he compared the trial testimony from the witnesses and he compared it to the autopsy report and the ballistics evidence. And he gave a report. It's his scientific conclusion that the description given by the state witnesses were fabricated because they conflicted with the autopsy report and described things that were physically impossible. They described the victim being shot multiple times in the chest, face area, when the autopsy report showed that all the shots were going from back to front.
Bullets don't have opinions. Bullets are not eyewitnesses. These are facts.
You can't be facing somebody face to face and shoot them in the back. Oh, on top of that, in 2024, a private investigator in Jamaica located a federal informant. And what's revealed that he actually did explain the same thing to the state prosecutor when they brought him in the office, when that I was an innocent bystander. And then at that point, he said, Sachs got animated and was angry and said, this would be an open and shut case if he identified me as a perpetrator, explaining to him that it would have negative implications on his upcoming federal sentencing and the plea agreement that he had signed if he didn't cooperate. So this report that the investigator submitted along with the Sirleaf report, those two things are currently in front of the court under another PCRA.
Trevor, we wish you all the luck in court. Even though you shouldn't need any well wishes in the first place, it certainly feels like you do. And if anyone listening has any information or wishes to support Trevor in any way, we'll make sure to link ways to reach him in our episode description. You'll see that he also goes by the name Anton Ford on Socialist. And with that, we go to our closing. You know, I'm just going to sit back here and listen to anything that Trevor has left to say. Let's let you have the last word.
All right. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to address your listeners. I've endured more than my full measure of injustice. As a result, I'm driven by a desire to do my part and to contribute everything I can to bend the moral arc of the universe towards more justice. I aspire to embody the virtues of revolutionary love, radical empathy, unapologetic kindness, and unconditional freedom. I was forged to lead in the bowels of a carceral cauldron of oppression, where I was subjected to unspeakable trials and tribulations at the hands of manifest injustice, systemic violence, and state-inflicted torture meant to terrorize and designed to dehumanize. Yet I survived. I was ground down by the millstone of oppression, tried by the fires of cruelty, and tested in the face of unmitigated brutality, yet I persevered to emerge edified, purified, and sanctified. I'm now obsessed with and possessed by an urgent need to call out, condemn, and deconstruct white supremacy, to love, care for, and nurture all and any authentic expression of humanity, to demand liberty, equity, and the humane treatment of the entire spectrum of nature, and to end injustice and all forms of exploitation. In the last 7 years, Philadelphia's Conviction Integrity Unit has released over 50 inmates who were wrongfully convicted, a total of more than 700 years spent incarcerated illegally. All of these black and brown people were sentenced to death by incarceration, a sentence euphemistically referred to as life without the possibility of parole. Note, these wrongful convictions occurred in Philadelphia County, and there are many more similar cases like mine yet to be reviewed. On June 19, 2023, Philadelphia District Attorney's Office released a racial injustice report. This report stated unequivocally that Philadelphia's criminal justice system is racist. This is irrefutable proof that the wrongful convictions uncovered and documented were not a matter of mistakes, nor the system being broken. No, this is institutional racism at work. And like all other institutional racisms, it's nefarious and amounts to social engineering. This is injustice by design. I argue that the wrongful convictions in Philadelphia are so pervasive that they cannot be tolerated by a civilized society. And we cannot defend on the current lethargic drip by drip, one case at a time judicial review process to address this pervasive systemic problem. Too many cases will be missed. We need an across-the-board legislative fix to remedy the cruel and unusual harms inflicted by the state-sanctioned convictions of innocent people. We need parole eligibility for lifers. There is no parole for lifers in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is one of the four states in the Union that still employs the barbaric, draconian sentencing scheme of mandatory life without the possibility of parole for murder. It's time to drag Pennsylvania's archaic crime code into the modern era of grace, mercy, and second chances. In February 2016, the United States Supreme Court in the case of Tuca versus Louisiana ruled that sentencing juvenile offenders, that is offenders 17 years and younger, to mandatory life without parole was unconstitutional. As a result of this ruling, Pennsylvania had to resentence over 500 juvenile lifers, many incarcerated for over 20 years. As of today, over 100 of these juvenile lifers have been resentenced and successfully reintegrated into society. Listen, there are more than 5,000 other lifers, many incarcerated over 20 years, languishing in prison in Pennsylvania. These other 5,000 lifers are no different, not by one jot nor by one iota, from the juvenile lifers who were paroled and successfully returned to the community. There is a moral imperative, if not legal equal protection case to be made, that parole eligibility must be extended to these other 5,000 lifers. These other 5,000 lifers, including myself, do not have to die in prison to keep society safe. I have a vision to make parole available to all eligible lifers in Pennsylvania. I'm talking about bending the moral arc of the universe towards more justice by ending the politics of injustice. To achieve this goal, I need substantial support and access to institutional resources. I want to create a non-profit organization called the Justice and Accountability Project to implement a comprehensive 5-year plan designed to achieve parole eligibility for lifers in Pennsylvania. I call upon all conscientious people who desire to help to join me on this mission. You may contact me on the social media platform of Instagram at my FanIAM23 page. That is FanIAM23, FANIAM23, to sign up for this cause. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
I think everything that might have dropped in 95 has been labeled the golden years of hip-hop.
It's Black Music Month, and We Need to Talk is tapping in. I'm Nyla Simone, breaking down lyrics, amplifying voices, and digging into the culture that shaped the soundtrack of our lives.
Like, that's what's really important, and that's what stands out, is that our music changes people's lives for the better.
Let's talk about the music that moves us. To hear this and more on how music and culture collide, listen to We Need to Talk from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up, y'all? This your main man, Memphis Bleek, right here, host the Rock Solid Podcast. June is Black Music Month, so what better way to celebrate than listening to my exclusive conversation with my bro, Ja Rule?
The one thing they can't stop you or take away from you is knowledge. So whatever I went through while I was down in prison for 2 years, through that process, learn from it.
Check out this exclusive episode with Ja Rule on Rock Solid. Open your free iHeartRadio app, search Rock Solid, and listen now.
I also want to address the Tonys.
On a recent episode of Checking In with Michelle Williams, I open up about feeling snubbed by the Tony Awards. Do I?
I was never mad. I was disappointed because I had high hopes.
To hear this and more on disappointment and protecting your peace, listen to Checking In with Michelle Williams from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.